Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Win one, lose one. As we edge closer to Sunday's vote on health care reform, the jockeying in Washington is rivaling the Kentucky Derby. Yesterday, Democrats lost Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch.
It's a sad day that we're facing this Senate bill.
But today, in a dramatic press conference surrounded by uninsured constituents, the Obama White House gained the vote of John Boccheri of Ohio.
These families are the face of the 16th Congressional District. They're the face of Ohio, and they're the face of America. And a nation as wealthy as ours, where we can spend $1 trillion on war, certainly we can find the resources to reform a system that is causing people to suffer so greatly.
Congressman John Boccheri of Ohio, who said yes, he is going to vote yes on health reform. We're going to check in Ohio, in Idaho, where they've passed a law allowing citizens to opt out of federally mandated health plans. Can they do that? And we're also going to check in on the ramifications of Stephen Lynch's switch of vote here in Massachusetts. But first, to what seems like a buzzing Washington, Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, President Obama spoke today at George Mason University to cheering partisans. But you've just come from a meeting with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What's going on?
This is a very intense day. One of the most striking things, just a few minutes ago, Peter DeFazio, a strong supporter of health care reform from Oregon, announced he was voting against it, unless they were able to undo what the Senate parliamentarian did this week. Apparently, the Senate parliamentarian has decided that there are procedural objections to a fix in the House bill that would have changed the regional allocate formula for allocating Medicare money. Congressman DeFazio and a lot of Midwesterners states feel that they have been underpaid. And as DeFazio just told a group of us, what's the point of passing health care reform if my constituents can't find doctors willing to service them because the federal rates are too low? So this is the sort of last-minute thing that is astonishing. DeFazio was on no one's watch list, and yet here he is at the moment, a solid no, unless the Speaker can pull a rabbit out of a hat and get the Senate parliamentarian to agree that something can go through.
Well, and then remind us, because there are rules, and the parliamentarian has to decide whether or not this can be reconciled at this point. So what are you hearing?
There are two big dramas right now. One, can you get the votes to pass the Senate bill? And two, how much are the fixes that they've pulled together to pass that bill going to be changed on the House, on the Senate side? And that is has to go through a very fine net of rules called the Byrd Rule for reconciliation. And that says that anything that doesn't have a budget impact can't go through. Anything that doesn't lower the deficit can't go through. And so that's the kind of last-minute maneuvering. The fact that they're still talking about it, that they don't yet have final language to take to the floor, is because of that process. They're hoping to fix all of this before 8 o'clock Saturday morning, when the Rules Committee actually takes up the language.
So a big roadblock suddenly for the Democrats. They need 216 votes, and we were just talking about all the jockeying. How close are they, especially with this recent defection?
Oh, this changes everything. I had heard they were as close as 8 votes, anywhere from 8 to 12. But the big uncertainty was still the abortion group. There are at least a dozen yes votes who are very concerned about this Senate language on abortion. But the fact that with Congressman Lynch and now another block of progressives splitting the program, that no one expected. That is a real surprise, and it's going to call on all of the great power and skill of the Speaker to try to pull it back together by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Well, here in Massachusetts, Democratic Representative Stephen Lynch, who voted for the House bill, is now saying the Senate bill isn't tough enough on insurance companies. Little background here. He's, of course, a Democrat from Massachusetts, which is suddenly potentially an endangered species. And he's interestingly asking for a tougher bill, which in some ways puts him to the left of many people here who are against health reform. They don't want any government intervention. So do you have a sense of what's going on there?
He's also a former union leader, and this is a fascinating backstory here. The unions are very upset at the funding mechanism in the Senate bill, which basically puts a lot of emphasis on an excise tax on high-end insurance programs. Well, unions have, for the last two or three cycles, have not pressed for wage increases, but for improvements in health insurance. So they are very, very upset about this. The AFL-CIO leader yesterday agreed to support health care reform. It's historic, but I can tell you for certainty there are a lot of his members that are not happy with his decision and not happy with this plan. And I'm wondering if Lynch's union background also is firing up his concern about this.
Well, and just quickly, do you think this came as a surprise to the Obama White House, or do you think, as some on the right are suggesting, this might be part of a plan to give some potentially endangered Democrats a pass?
Oh, there are plenty of passes to give around. That's what is the genius of this Democratic Speaker Pelosi's operation. She completely understands that. She knows these districts very well. And this is an issue with every bill. The blue dogs are often given passes, and the fact that they have such a robust majority is what allows them to do this. Now, if members take a big hit in November, which is what Republicans assert will absolutely happen and what a lot of Democrats are concerned about, if she still has a majority, it could be a much lesser majority, and so it makes it harder to give people a buy on a big vote like this. Yeah. But she wasn't talking just a few minutes ago as if she was looking for buys. She quoted what John Lewis, fabled civil rights leader, told the caucus yesterday. He said, "We may not have chosen this time, but this time has chosen us to pass health care." I mean, that's the level at which people are talking at this point, even as they beat back these last-minute astonishing surprises.
Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We're going to let you go back to do your good work. We reserve the right to ask you to call us should anything else happen. And you make everything that happens in Congress sound exciting. So
It just so happens that it is right
it
now.
It is. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
But let's turn now to Julian Zelitzer to help put this into context. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Terrific read. And Julian, do that for us. What about this arm twisting, the tortured rules, Republicans crying foul, and as we're hearing, Democrats making last minute maneuvers. We're hearing 'twas always thus. Put it into context.
Absolutely. All we're seeing is the legislative process at work, and we're seeing it a little closer because of things like the internet. Every time we had a major piece of legislation, if you look at the archives, if you hear the tapes, when it comes down to the last few days, this is what it's all about. It's not very sophisticated. All it is about arm twisting. It's about vote counting and getting people in the right column and not the wrong column, as a lot of congressional operators like to say.
And some people say, you're never going to remember the process. You just remember the legislation, which is why they keep doing it. I don't know if do you agree with that?
That's usually true. I mean, in general, people will talk, 4 weeks from now about the bill and the merits and problems with the bill. That said, there are moments when one party or the other is able to make the process an issue, to say the process through which things are passed, reflects that the majority is corrupt or the majority created an illegitimate bill. Republicans have been very good at doing this, actually, since the Newt Gingrich era in the 1980s when Gingrich rose to power. It's been a central argument. But usually the process is interesting for a few days, and in the long term, the debate comes down to the legislation itself.
Well, but you and others have compared this to the Johnson era fight for civil rights, and I've heard people say, that was a brawl, and you don't remember that. You remember the legislation. Make some comparisons to Johnson.
Absolutely. I mean, with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is the first kind of major piece of legislation he gets. And the kind of heat over that bill, I think, is greater than what you see today. I mean, in the states, people were getting murdered over this bill. In states like Mississippi, members of Congress in the South are not just scared about losing their seats. They, in fact, don't think they're going to lose their seats. They're scared about legislation that's fundamentally going to change the way life is in the South. And the kind of anger and the kind of animosity was even greater. The stakes were higher in their perception than the health care. But in the end, the process was able to cobble together a bill that has lasted for decades.
But, Julian, some of these bills in the past ended up in the court. So here's what we want to do. If Julian Zelitzer of Princeton University could just stand by for a second, we want to turn to another story, is how states are taking a look at this. So, Julian, stand by. Because under the banner of states' rights, a number of states are attempting to head off moves by the federal government to require citizens to buy insurance. This week, Idaho Republican Butch Otter became the first governor to sign into law a measure requiring his state attorney general to sue the federal government over mandates. Governor Otter says the Idaho Health Freedom Act will help protect states' rights. Joining us now, Jill Caritis, the Boise editor for the online magazine NewWest.net. Tell us a little bit, Jill, about what the feeling is there in Idaho.
Well, it's interesting. There is no real assurance here that the Idaho Health Freedom Act can become law. The state, Idaho, has a centrist Republican Attorney General, Larry Wasden, who has a history of not tilting at legal windmills. So if it was pushed, if there was a legal fight over whether this was unconstitutional or not, Wasden has the sole power to decide whether Idaho would sue the federal government or pursue the case in court.
Well, what is federal,
and he has a history of not doing that.
Well, what does federal law say? I mean, doesn't federal law trump state law?
It really looks like it does, and that's why I think it's quite unlikely that that it would go much further than the Attorney General's office where it sits right now.
Well, but on the other hand, your governor there says there's similar legislation pending in 37 states.
Yeah.
Enough for a constitutional amendment.
That's right. But keep in mind, for example, the Equal Rights Amendment in the 70s, took more than a decade and then never did pass. A U.S. constitutional amendment is an enormous undertaking. It would take a long time if it worked at all. And by that time, President Obama would be out of power. It's very unrealistic.
Well, and just to get a taste of the West while we have you, a public radio poll released this week showed 41% of people in the Northwest, Washington State, Idaho, Oregon, oppose health care reform. They want their states to opt out. What are some of the reasons for opposition?
Well, this is an anti-federal government state. It's an old-fashioned giving my gun, my dog, and get off my land kind of states' rights state, keeping in mind that Boise, the capital, is a progressive area, but there are vast rural areas of Idaho. Remember, it borders six states and Canada, so it's a huge state. And in these rural areas, there are places who have never had any internet at all. There are huge numbers of people who have no technology experience, who are afraid of technology and afraid of privacy intrusions.
And in some places, you the doctor gives you care and you give the doctor a chicken. Jill, we're up against a break. That's Jill Caritis from Boise, Idaho, editor for the online magazine NewWest.net. Jill, thank you so much for the update there.
Sure, you're welcome.
And when we come back, we go to Ohio, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the debate on Capitol Hill, which is buzzing today about health care reform. Democrats say they're going to take the vote this weekend. It's hard to remember that it all began during the summer town hall showdowns, continued through the debate as the health care reform measure made its stop-and-go way through Congress. In towns and cities across the country, citizens, often backed by large and well-financed national Republican organizations, have been trying to sway representatives to vote for or against the bill. We got a taste of the emotional outpouring earlier this week.
You were saying something
I'm
wrong.
Not talking to you, sir. This America, I can say anything I want. This
so
is everything.
See, that's a nice part. So can I.
That's right.
Pro and anti-health care bill forces squaring off at a simultaneous opposing rallies at the district office of Ohio Democratic Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy. Joining us now, Catherine Kandisky, a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Catherine, first of all, news from Ohio. Congressman John Boccheri announcing he would vote yes for the bill. Thoughts?
That's right. That just came this morning. Well, he is a Democrat in a big swing state. This is a tough vote for him. He's going to have a tough race in November. But as you heard him say, he ultimately decided to do what he felt was right, was trying not to worry so much as he thinks some others are about the consequences of that vote.
Well, he was surrounded by constituents, a mother with a child with autism who could not get insurance, another woman whose sister had died without insurance, and a man who had a heart attack and said he lost his house because he couldn't get insurance for a pre-existing heart condition, having had the heart attack. And yet, when he was, you know, asked to be clear, what would Congressman Boccheri do? Here's what he said.
Yes, I will be voting yes for the bill.
So, Catherine, applause from his supporters there, but we hear that there have been banners being flown around on airplanes telling him not to vote for this, a lot of pressure. What do you think the fallout's going to be?
Well, I think this is going to be a big issue in the upcoming election. I think a lot of these folks in there's a lot of swing districts in our state. There's a lot of tight races that we'll see. And I think this is going to be an issue on both sides. I think that in some ways I'm not sure it even matters how he would have voted. I think it's going to be an issue for the Democrats in the state.
Well, Congresswoman Kilgroy supported the House version. She hasn't officially said how she'll vote this time around. She's expected to be in the yes column. There are other undecided Ohio Democrats. What does it feel like there? We heard some of that rally. What does it feel like?
It really feels like we're in the heat of a presidential race. It feels very much like it did in 2008. We have a lot of very large and active conservative groups here in Ohio. The Tea Party movement's very active here. Americans for Prosperity, there's several. And likewise, we have some very active progressive groups. Progress Ohio here in the central Ohio area. There's a group from Upper Arlington, which is really kind of thought of as a more conservative suburb of Columbus. But in the last few years, there's been a group there that's been very active in progressive causes.
Well, and it's gotten pretty heated. We heard some of the sounds from the rally. At another moment, someone who was for the health bill was ridiculed by anti-health care bill supporters. Let's listen.
If you're looking for a handout, you're in the wrong end of town. Nothing for free over here. You have to work for everything you get.
No, I'll pay for this guy. Here we go. Start a pot.
This was Robert Letcher, who has Parkinson's disease. He had a sign telling people that he had Parkinson's disease and, as we heard, ridiculed by people against health care reform. The video of this incident went viral. Is there a danger of backlash on both sides, that if Tea Party activists win, that we'll be seeing more and more images, which you really haven't seen, of people who need health care, and it's a backlash against people against health care reform? Or on the other hand, Obama might win the bill and lose in November?
It was really an unbelievable scene, and I think I've had people on both sides of the issue condemn the behavior of those two men, the opponents of the health care bill, because it really looked bad. I mean, here was a frail, sickly man, and they were you know, making fun of. But I think that it also underscores the passion on both sides. You know, we've had a lot of comments on our website. That video, in the first day and a half it was posted, had over 16,000 hits, which is a lot for us. I think it shows how the real passions of people here, and there's a lot of people defending the action and criticizing that guy for taking a handout. It turns out he is someone who's on disability and is insured through the government's Medicaid program.
Well, you could say he took a handout. People were throwing money at him. So
they were.
Catherine Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch in Columbus, Ohio, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we just have a couple minutes just to check back in with Julian Zelitzer, talk about the heat in Ohio. You said compared to other times in history, you know, not so much. But just quick question, do you think this is going to end up in the courts with states, as we heard, already passing laws allowing their citizens to opt out of a mandate if it's passed?
I think the courts will be one threat. I think the bigger threat will be a Republican push to either repeal or severely revise the legislation. There are already plans for this. The benefits for many people won't kick in for several years. So there'll be this gap period where people are starting to pay more but not yet seeing the benefits. And I think Republicans between now and 2014 are going to try to undermine the legislation, probably through the legislative process, more effectively than the judicial process. And that's that's where Medicare proponents are going to have to do their hardest work. Medical health care proponents will have to do their hardest work.
And that's, with the minute we have left, that's the biggest problem, isn't it, for the Obama administration? This doesn't take effect for years.
Absolutely. Certain benefits will take effect, and some of the regulations might go into place. But many of the benefits in these exchanges, the Expedia for healthcare, will take several years before Americans see it. So it's a vulnerable program. You never want a program where people have to pay more up front and get benefits later, but that's what they're going to get. So after the Congress finishes, the politics might just heat up.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Also, his latest book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Terrific read. Julian, though, commenting on health care, the Democrats say they're going to put it to a vote this weekend. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Of course, anything happens, we'll bring it to you. But meanwhile, we'll take a break and be back with the very latest news. And just to, you know, relieve us all, Finch's playing guitars. That's later, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ordinary people do extraordinary things. We know that. But they're not often recognized. So 3 years ago, the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation, which usually honors the military, began recognizing civilians. Three recipients of the Citizen Service Above Self Award will be announced on Monday. There are 20 nominees. A man stopped an out-of-control bus filled with 44 children. Another performed life-saving surgeries in Haiti. An 18-year-old student gave his life drowning while saving the lives of his younger brother and cousin. Well, then there's 26-year-old Chilan Ta and her partner, 29-year-old Michelle Kleisath. The couple lives in Seattle, and while traveling in Washington, D.C., they saved a disabled woman who'd fallen onto the metro train tracks. They both join us now from Seattle. Chilan, let's start with you. Describe when you first realized something had happened.
Well, we were standing on the platform of a metro station, I think waiting for the last train of the night, chatting amongst ourselves, and then I hear this loud yelling at the end of the platform, and I think, oh, I don't really know what's going on. It doesn't seem like anything too serious. And then I see this person is still yelling, and I think, okay, there must be something, but let me just walk over and see what's going on. So I walk over and look down on the tracks, and then I see a body down there, and I see a device, which I realized later that it was her wheelchair. So when I realized that, I decided the best thing to do is that, okay, there's a train coming. That needs to be stopped. If anyone's going to go down the tracks, the train is about to come, and that would be a disaster. So I walked up the stairs of the platform to the station manager and said, do you know what's going on? There's a person on the tracks. We need to stop that train that's coming. And then he responded, followed me down the platform.
So you went up to alert the station manager. Michelle, in the meantime, you're still down on the platform. What did you do?
Well, the person who had originally seen the woman on the tracks was saying, someone call 911. And I actually pulled out my cell phone and I just kind of looked at it for about a second. And then I just thought, there isn't enough time for emergency responders to get this message and be here. And then I saw the woman who was on the tracks, and she was saying, please come down and help me. Please come down and help me. It was really scary to just stand there and know that someone had to go down, and everyone was hesitating. And then I thought, okay, well, we only have so much time. One of us has to go down there and get her off, so I'm going to go down there.
So you climb down on the tracks. Now, what are you thinking when you're doing this? Were you thinking about the third rail, you know, the danger of being down there?
No, the first thing I thought was, if the train comes, I am standing, and the train operator will be able to see me if I stand and wave my arms to stop the train, just in case it comes. And then as soon as I got down there, the woman who had fallen was giving me very clear directions about I needed to turn her over, get her on her back, and then pick her up. She was actually very calm, and that really helped me to know what I needed to do to help her.
Well, you asked onlookers for help lifting the woman out. Eventually, everyone was safely up on the platform. But then you go back down to get the woman's wheelchair. Now, we know the station manager cut power to that dangerous third rail because Chilan ran to tell him what was going on. But, Michelle, still, you went back for the chair?
Yeah, the woman asked us to. She said, you know, I need my chair. I realized there's another very important part of her is down there on the tracks, and we need to get that, too. I also did think if the train came and hit the chair that maybe people on the train could get hurt.
So now you're both nominated for this high honor, a congressional medal, the Citizen Service Above Self Award. How do you feel about all of this, Jalon?
Well, the nomination was quite surprising because, in my mind, the actions that Michelle and I took and the other folks involved, kind of just something that you need to do when you're in that situation. And it doesn't seem like it's anything that should be recognized and rewarded in this way, but it's still an honor to know that there's people who do recognize that it's valuable to care for other people's lives and care for humanity.
That's Jalon Ta, a 26-year-old engineering student. Her partner is 29-year-old Michelle Kleisheth. She's studying for her doctorate in anthropology. Both speaking to us from Seattle, both nominated for a Citizen Service Above Self Award for rescuing a disabled woman who'd fallen on the D.C. metro tracks. The Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation will announce the winners on Monday. Either way, thanks so much and congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, When Birds Play Guitars, and later today, the Emmy-winning actor Bryan Cranston, star of the hit show Breaking Bad. Back in 1 minute, here and now. The Barbican Art Center in London has become something of an aviary. The French artist Celeste Borsier-Mugenot created a walk-through, sound-rich installation piece, 40 tiny zebra finches flying around, occasionally alighting on electric guitars wired to speakers. It's a big hit. The BBC's Vincent Dowd went for a listen.
The Barbican's curved gallery is a tall, thin space between thick concrete walls. Normally, it couldn't be more urban. But for the next couple of months, Celeste Borsier-Mugenot has turned it into an enchanted place for the tired city soul. It's the second time he's used zebra finches in an installation, but this time he gambled on their skills on the electric guitar. There are eight of them at waist height on which the birds settle, squabble or snooze, or just stare at the human beings. The exhibition curator is Lydia Yee.
What's the thing with finches? As far as you know, why is he so attracted to them?
Well, he likes this particular breed of zebra finch because they're quite calm, they're used to being around people, they're domesticated, and they respond and react well to the instruments and the sound.
How do they respond to that kind of sound, to big electrical guitar sounds underneath their feet? Do they like it?
Maybe they're trying to parody the kind of big macho guitarists by being these very delicate creatures that land on these instruments. Or maybe they don't know the difference and they're just it's just another place to perch.
The exhibition opened a couple of weeks ago with little fanfare. But now, 250,000 people have watched a related clip on YouTube. Londoners, it appears, can't get enough of chattering electro finches.
It's not what I expected at all, because I don't think I was expecting live birds for a start. And the interaction between the noise the birds make and the heavy bass of the guitar is fabulous.
I think it's something that makes me feel really happy.
You see, with everyone walking around, they've got big smiles on their faces.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I think it's because it's a really simple thing, and it's just a really, you know, it's really straightforward, and it's just really quite joyful.
Borsier-Mugenot created a work to surprise and delight the city dweller, and word has spread fast, not slowly through reviews, but rapidly and virally, by email and Facebook, and of course, these days, by tweet.
The BBC's Vincent Dowd. You have to see this. Beak as pick. The video's at our website, hereandnow.org. Well, let's take a few minutes now to air some of your thoughts. Many of you wrote about our look at efforts at the state and federal level to legislate awareness of postpartum depression. We spoke with Dr. Jean Driscoll, co-author of Postpartum Mood and Anxiety Disorders, A Guide, and also an advocate of a proposal here in Massachusetts that would require that all new mothers be offered screening. Rita from Marblehead, Massachusetts, represented a lot of listeners who appreciated the segment, but she had her own personal twist. She writes, "Hearing Dr. Driscoll's voice, I was propelled back 15 years to when I suffered postpartum depression. I remember Jean Driscoll saying, 'Trust me,' when it was time for me to try medication for an underlying depression that was exacerbated when I gave birth. I'd called my primary care doctor from a closet a few days after giving birth, only to have him tell me it was baby blues, it would pass. It didn't. I was terrified by the thoughts I had and the images that went with them. I had no idea how much I was suffering until the medication took effect. I'm not sure screening will be the answer, but I do believe awareness is the key. Well, some of you were dead set against screening because you see it as a big pharma-backed way to get women on drugs. Several of you pointed out that many of the women who killed themselves or their children while suffering from the most severe postpartum psychosis had been on medication. Terry Bearden of Arizona writes, the FDA has ordered many of these medications to carry a black box warning that they may cause suicide. While Dr. Driscoll assured us she doesn't automatically prescribe drugs, that's not been the case when mass screenings are concerned. And Amy Philo of the website uniteforlife.org is actively working against legislation. We'll link you to her website at ours. She writes, Zoloft caused me to become suicidal and homicidal. Drugging of childbearing women must stop. Well, a couple of additional points. Ivy Shi Liang writes, mandatory screening being considered in Massachusetts means mandatory for the doctor to offer it. The patient is not required to take it. And Sandy Holland of South Bend, Indiana, has the final word. She writes, while I support screening, please remember that people on antidepressants may find it affects their ability to get insurance. Okay, switching gears. We spoke recently with Mr. Magazine himself, Samir Hosni, director of the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi School of Journalism. He talked about the enduring appeal of magazines, and that prompted many of you to tell us your favorites. For Hillary Law of Rossendale, Massachusetts, it's been Saudi Aramco World Magazine, just because it's foreign and beautiful and free. Judy Hawkins loves Messing About in Boats. That's the magazine. John Landy says he used to shoot competitively, but most firearms magazines got too right-wing. So now he subscribes to American Handloader and Combat Handguns. And then there was Diane Thomas of Kansas City, Kansas. When Mr. Magazine described that wait at the mailbox for a monthly subscription, it prompted memories for Diane. We caught her at her mom's house in Arkansas. Diane, you say for you it was Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine.
I was always anxious to receive it because I could curl up with it each night.
When you got older, you even had your mom send it to you in Scotland when you were studying there?
Yes. When I would receive it, I would frequently take it down to the North Sea and sit there reading the magazine while watching the waves come in.
And not only did he prompt a memory for you, but he prompted a resubscription.
Yes, I'd allowed it to lapse a few years ago when finances were getting tight, and listening to his story made me think, you know, there's just certain things that you don't really want to cut your expenses on, and I'll have to start reading it to my son.
Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One final quick note today. We often get letters and comments about music we play during the show. Inevitably, someone saying, I can't believe you played Pantera. Au contraire, our listeners are big Pantera fans. Pat Kelleher writes, while driving my sick high school son home from school, listening to Here and Now, he reached to turn up the radio. I was shocked, but the background song was Cemetery Gates by the band Pantera. He proceeded to show me he was wearing a Pantera shirt and gave me a whole story about the history of the band, how the founder, Dimebag Darrell Abbott, was shot and killed on stage in a shooting spree that killed three others. Anyway, that was a lot to get out of a 15-year-old. Thank you. You're welcome. We're glad to be a conversation starter. You can join in. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or to call. And you can scroll down and leave a comment as well. You can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Back in 1 minute. Here and Now. Welcome back. That theme music from AMC's critically acclaimed Breaking Bad sets the tone for an intense and unpredictable third season. The show features Bryan Cranston as Walt White, an upstanding chemistry teacher turned morally bankrupt crystal meth dealer. Walt turned to cooking meth after being diagnosed with lung cancer so he could make money to leave his pregnant wife and disabled teenage son, a seemingly noble goal. But then, in the second season, Walt is cured and keeps cooking meth, and any remnants of nobility disappear. His marriage is in ruins. In the third season premiere Sunday night, Walt tries to convince his wife, Skylar, to stay with him, even though she's begun to uncover his seedy second life.
You come in here and you wave these papers in my face when there's a whole other entire side to this thing. There's your side and there's my side, and you haven't heard my side yet. You haven't heard any of it at all.
You're a drug dealer.
And Walt's partner in crime is Jesse, a former student and burnout, played by Aaron Paul. Paul's received an Emmy nomination for his work. Bryan Cranston, as Walt, has won two Emmys, and they both join us. Bryan, welcome.
Robin, how are you?
I'm fine. And Aaron Paul, who many of us also know from his role in Big Love as the polygamous daughter's husband. Aaron, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And Bryan, start with you. For the uninitiated, take us through some of the lines that your character, Walt, crosses during the first two seasons.
Well, the interesting concept about this show was from the onset. Vince Gilligan, who was our writer-creator, said that he wanted to start a series with a character. In this case, Walter White, who is a chemistry teacher turning 50, going through depression because of missed opportunities in his life. He has a wife, a teenage son with cerebral palsy, a child on the way, has to work a second job in order to pay his bills. And on top of all that, he finds out that he has terminal lung cancer. So with that kind of bombardment of elements, he takes a giant risk and decides that he doesn't want to go out this way. He doesn't want to leave a legacy of illness and leave his family destitute. So he decides to cook crystal meth for maybe the year that he has left to live and support his family financially, posthumously.
We've done reporting here on crystal meth and what it does. It, you know, makes 25-year-olds look 90, makes mothers ignore their children. Did you find yourself, you know, looking into that world in real life to research it?
The only research that I really focused on was the chemistry background, because that's what my character knew. I wanted to discover and learn about crystal meth as my character would learn about it. It was controversial. I thoroughly expected to receive some harsh criticism for it, but remarkably, we didn't. And I think that's a testament to the show, that people realize it's not about drug use or manufacturing. It's not glorifying that. It's about this good man who makes a bad decision and how that's compounded. And it starts that downward spiral.
And Aaron Paul, it certainly is, as Brian's been saying, it doesn't romanticize things. There's a great scene between both of you in Sunday night's season opener. Aaron, your character, Jesse, has just gotten out of drug rehab. You know, we're wondering if he's going to, you know, pull himself out of this abyss.
Yeah, he's definitely going to, you know, make it a valiant effort to stay on the clean and sober path. He lost his love at the end of last season because of a drug overdose, and he's blaming himself 100% because of that.
And in this scene, you're both talking about a plane crash that, in fact, your characters, you know, helped cause in a roundabout way. Walt's trying to rationalize what happened. Jesse, again, the younger character, doesn't accept that. Let's listen.
You either run from things or you face them, Mr. White.
What exactly does that mean?
I learned it in rehab. It's all about accepting who you really are. I accept who I am.
And who are you?
I'm the bad guy.
Aaron, just asking you again there, the bad guy. You know, what did you do to research your character?
You know, I spent many hours kind of watching. I got addicted to the show Intervention. And, you know, I really saw how drugs not only affected the people using them, but the people around them.
What did you see in the show Intervention? Because that's also a kind of a controversial reality show, though, where people, you know, addicts try to kick their habit right in front of cameras. But what did you see in faces or in mannerisms that maybe you picked up?
You just really see how the drug completely has control of them. And, you know, at the beginning, they kind of have a choice. But then towards the end, it's almost not even their fault anymore. At the end of the day, the drug has control of them. It's hard to fight.
Bryan Cranston, in some interviews, you've said that executive producer Vince Gilligan has clued you in a little bit into how far your character would fall. What has shocked you?
there's going to be people who are not liking where my character is going. He becomes and will become a drug kingpin by the end of this series. What makes a man do that? What elements could change someone from one type of person to another? And my character is currently in that transition. In this third season, he's going to make another couple leaps. He's down a path that he can't return on.
Brian, you directed the first episode of the new season. It opens with this scene of people, they're crawling along the desert floor on their bellies, painfully advancing. You know, the opening scene is part of a larger puzzle that's revealed over the season. Ted, can you just tell us a little bit about that?
What happens this season on Breaking Bad is that it expands exponentially. And what happens is that we realize that Walt, his actions are affecting everyone. They're stepping on the cartel, and so it expands that way. In the opening sequence of the third season, we see these worshippers of Santa Muerte, which is a real religion, so to speak, and a branch of Catholicism that happened years ago. And it's a very odd, very compelling entry into our third season.
What does it mean? They're crawling to this altar.
The Santa Muerte is a deity that does not discriminate on what your prayers or wishes are. You could wish for someone to get well, or you can wish for someone to die. So that's what we're using. These two characters who are introduced in the first episode and who they're wishing to place ill on. And you have to buckle your seatbelts because it unwinds from there.
Well, and Aaron, one last question for you. Will the senator and his many wives be publicly ridiculed, or will they make it through this year of him in public office?
I missed that part of Breaking Bad.
I've switched, of course, to Big Love. And just if you don't mind, just one last question to Aaron Paul, who is, of course, on one of our other favorite shows, Big Love, on HBO.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? The polygamist has gone public.
When Bill decided to run for office, I'm like, oh, my God, he is out of his mind. But he's doing it, so who knows?
Just don't get that mixed up with the chemistry teacher who decides to sell crystal methamphetamine.
Exactly.
Aaron Paul and Bryan Cranston, stars of AMC's Breaking Bad. The third season begins this Sunday night at 10, and it's the story of how crystal methamphetamine just leaves nothing but destruction in its path. Bryan Cranston, Aaron Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.